It's Wednesday, March 20, 2013. I'm Albert Moeller, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. One of the most important articles on marriage to appear in recent times has been summarized in the weekend edition of The Wall Street Journal. The article is written by researchers Kay Hemnewitz, W. Bradford Wilcox, and Colleen Kay, and they begin with a stunning assessment, quote, "For many Americans, the phrase young single mother conjures up a picture of a teenage high school dropout, but that image is out of date. Teen pregnancy rates have been declining for two decades now. Today's typical unmarried mother is a high school graduate in her early 20s who may very well be living with her child's father," end quote. These three researchers have recently released a major research report on the failure of young adults to marry. It is matched with the fact that even as they are not getting married, they are having children. As Hemnewitz, Wilcox, and Kay report, despite her apparent advantages, however, speaking of the older single mom over the younger, she faces many of the same problems that we used to associate with her younger sisters. If 30 is the new 20, today's unmarried 20-somethings are the new teen moms, and the tragic consequences are much the same. Children raised in homes that often put them at an enormous disadvantage from the very start of life. In a very perceptive bit of analysis, Hemnewitz, Wilcox, and Kay look at the stereotypical image of the 20-something in America today. They write, "Thanks in part to TV shows like Girls and predecessors like Friends, we tend to think of today's 20-something years as kind of a post-adolescent transitional period. Young adults move in and out of jobs and careers, hang out at cafes and bars with friends, test drive romantic partners, and just try to figure themselves out." They then write, "This pop cultural depiction is accurate enough for the top third or so of Americans who have a four-year college degree, but it's a long way from the reality of most 20-somethings. By the time they turn 30, about two-thirds of American women have had their first child, usually outside of marriage." Let me repeat that last sentence. It's a stunning bit of cultural information. Quote, "By the time they turn 30, about two-thirds of American women have had their first child, usually outside of marriage," end quote. The age here is not so significant. It's not stunning that by the time a woman reaches 30, she has had a child. That has been a constant throughout human history. What is stunning is the word usually put in front of the words outside of marriage. In other words, it is now the usual course of events. There is a greater than average chance that a woman, by the time she is 30, who has her first child, has it outside of marriage. Hemnewitz and Wilcox and Kay then write this, "Indeed, 20-somethings are driving America's all-time high level of non-marital childbearing, which is now at 41% of all births, according to vital statistics data from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. 60% of these births are to women in their 20s, while teens account for only one-fifth of non-marital births. Between 1990 and 2008, the teen pregnancy rate has dropped by 42%, while the rate of non-marital childbearing among 20-something women has risen by 27%, end quote. For some time now, researchers have been looking at the fact that marriage has been marginalized. In the first sense, it has been marginalized in terms of the age continuum. Whereas the age of first marriage for a white male as recently as three decades ago was in the low 20s, it is now over 28 and headed for 29. There are no signs that this trend is going to be reversed anytime soon. But there's another trend here, and it has to do with the fact that marriage is being marginalized because an increasing number of Americans aren't getting married at all. Some of them aren't getting married at all over their lifetime, at no point. But an increasing number are getting married, but with no reference to the beginning of romantic coupling, nor to the activity of having children. But there is a new class divide in America, and it is the opposite of what many people might think. For instance, just as recently as 30 or 40 years ago, it was blue-collar America, the so-called working-class Americans, who actually kept to the moral conservatism of American culture. But now it appears that the opposite is taking place. It was thought by theorists back in the 60s and 70s that those who had a college education, young Americans with greater social mobility and ability to gain income, perhaps had the greatest opportunity to put at risk the kind of behaviors that would end up with, for instance, out-of-wedlock births. But now the opposite is actually the reality. Young women who have a college education and upward social mobility are least likely to have a child out of wedlock, while those in the lower third of the socioeconomic data are more likely, indeed most likely, to have a child and then perhaps even additional children out of wedlock. The data indicate that among college-educated women, only 12% of first births are outside of marriage. Remember that the national data now, the average for out-of-wedlock births, is running at 41%. Among those young women who are under the age of 30, who are in the lower economic brackets, the majority of first children are born outside of marriage. What these three researchers intend to indicate by this data is not just that America is in the midst of a massive social transformation. It's not just that America is even in the grip of a major moral transformation, but rather, they appear to be pointing to the reality that the tectonic plates under the nation's moral surface are now shifting to such an extent that we have to wonder about the survivability of marriage as a social expectation. Their research is part of an important new project known as Not Yet, that's K-N-O-T, Yet, the Benefits and Costs of Delayed Marriage in America. A chilling article on abortion and medical ethics appeared in yesterday's edition of the New York Times. It refers back to a grisly discovery made over 2 years ago in a dingy abortion clinic in Philadelphia that became quickly described as a house of horrors. John Hurdle, reporting for the New York Times, says, in opening statements in court on Monday, prosecutors charged that a doctor who operated a women's health clinic here killed 7 viable fetuses by plunging scissors into their necks and snipping their spinal cords, and was also responsible for the death of a pregnant woman in his care, end quote. Some of you will no doubt remember that grisly discovery in Philadelphia about 2 years ago in the abortion clinic of Dr. Kermit Gosnell, now age 72, who has since been charged with 7 counts of first-degree murder, as well as multiple counts of conspiracy, criminal solicitation, and violation of a state law that forbids abortions after the 24th week of pregnancy. Dr. Gosnell was the operator and physician at the Women's Medical Society in West Philadelphia. John Hurdle's report in the New York Times is rather comprehensive, going back to the details of that grisly discovery, including the fact that body parts of aborted fetuses of vitable age were discovered in his clinic. Also, Dr. Gosnell is charged with the death of a woman who came in at an advanced stage of pregnancy. This woman was given a pain-killing drug during her labor, but the patient reacted badly and died after being taken to a nearby hospital. Prosecutors in Philadelphia have blamed Dr. Gosnell for her death. Prosecutors have accused 9 of Dr. Gosnell's staff members with crimes related to violating abortion laws, perjury, and other charges. All but 1 of these staff members have pleaded guilty, including Dr. Gosnell's wife, Pearl. In opening arguments in Philadelphia, prosecutors said, quote, if the baby is alive and you don't want it to be, that doesn't mean you have the right to take a pair of scissors and plunge it into the baby's neck. That statement was made by Joanne Pescatori, an assistant district attorney there in Philadelphia. But we need to note what's really at stake here. Of course, the crime that Dr. Gosnell is charged of committing in the case of these fetuses is the killing of a baby after the stage of viability, or after the 24-month period that establishes the outer limit for legal abortions there in the state of Pennsylvania. But there's something else going on here, because what Dr. Gosnell was doing is what has been characterized as partial birth abortion. He was delivering the babies live, but in the case of partial birth abortion, the actual murder of the baby takes place before the head is finally removed from the birth canal. In this case, Dr. Gosnell did not even follow that kind of grotesque moral charade. He simply delivered the baby and then, according to prosecutors, used the scissors to snip its spinal cord. The distinction here, of course, is one that is of more than legal significance. But when we look at the issue of abortion, what moral sense does it make to charge this doctor with murder while allowing doctors to do almost exactly the same thing and face no charges whatsoever? This gets back to the fact that many abortion rights activists, indeed most, if not all, of the major abortion rights activist organizations, have adamantly opposed any restriction on abortion, including the partial birth abortion ban. What we're looking at here is an absolute denial of the moral status of the fetus. By the way, at the end of the article by John Hurdle, we read this paragraph. Rebutting prosecution claims that Dr. Gosnell was profiting from the desperation of poor women. Mr. McMahon, that is his attorney, said that his client had passed up lucrative positions in obstetrics and gynecology so that he could provide an essential service in West Philadelphia, where, and here again, this is coming from his defense attorney, he had performed more than 16,000 abortions over 31 years. Folks, when you look at this story, you realize that the grisly discovery is not just all the matter that was discovered in that abortion clinic more than 2 years ago. It's what took place at that abortion clinic from the very beginning, the beginning of a trail of terror that included 16,000 abortions over 31 years. And now for a surprise that's not a surprise at all. USA Today reported yesterday, former and perhaps future presidential candidate Hillary Rodham Clinton endorsed same-sex marriage in a video released on Monday. She said, quote, "I support it personally and as a matter of policy and law, embedded in a broader effort to advance equality and opportunity for LGBT, that's lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgendered Americans, and all Americans." David Jackson, reporting for USA Today, says, Clinton's declaration puts her in line with other potential 2016 Democratic presidential candidates and with President Obama. The White House, by the way, praised former Secretary of State Clinton's statement. President Obama's spokesman Jay Kerry said, quote, "Obama believes it's always a good thing for public officials to speak out in favor of equality for gays and lesbians." Jackson reports the same-sex marriage is picking up support from amongst the public. He cites an ABC News Washington Post poll released in recent days that finds that 58% of respondents now say it should be legal for gays and lesbians to wed, up from 32% in 2004. The final paragraph of David Jackson's article gets right to the point. Quote, "Democratic strategist Steve Elmendorf said anyone who seeks the presidency has to favor gay marriage to win in the 2016 Democratic primaries, because the issue has taken on great symbolic significance for many voters, particularly young ones," end quote. This statement in the article here in USA Today gets right to the point, or we should say almost to the threshold of the point. It doesn't get to the actual point, which is this. Senator Clinton was against this policy before she was for it. Not only was she against it before she ran for president in 2008, she was against the legalization of same-sex marriage when she ran for president in 2008, adamantly on the campaign trail, saying that she supported civil unions, but did not support the legalization of same-sex marriage. Furthermore, even though we're again in one of those patterns of that was then and this is now, candidate Hillary Clinton in 2008 said that the issue of the definition of marriage should be left up to the individual states. Now, on this video made for the Human Rights Campaign, she's not only calling for the legalization of same-sex marriage, she is calling for the legalization of same-sex marriage in all 50 states. And she implies in the video it should be by any means necessary, including a sweeping Supreme Court decision such as that of Roe v. Wade in 1972. But the politics behind this was at least referenced twice in David Jackson's article. The timing of this is hardly a coincidence. Hillary Clinton may or may not be running for president in 2016, running for the Democratic presidential nomination, but she is clearly hoping to keep the option open. And the only way to keep that option open in the year 2013 is to be now openly and avidly in favor of the legalization of same-sex marriage. But that points to an issue which is hardly and very rarely addressed in the national media. Where is the credibility or the integrity with all these public officials, or in the case of Secretary Clinton, former public officials, who decide that now is the time to reverse themselves on this issue? And who is noticing that the language they use, and this applies to President Obama as well, includes a sweeping moral declaration that is completely condemnatory of what they themselves believed, presumably, just hours before? President Obama, for example, now speaks with open condescension, moral condescension, of those who do not share his current position that same-sex marriage should be legalized. But remember, he adamantly held to the opposite position until one specific day last year when he decided to announce that he had taken the contrary position. After, you may recall, he had described his own progress on the issue as evolution. Now, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton has joined her husband, who made his own declaration in the Washington Post just a matter of a few weeks ago. The Democratic policy lineup is now becoming increasingly clear, and so perhaps is the lineup for the 2016 Democratic primaries. And I think Steve Elmendorf, the Democratic consultant and advisor cited in this USA Today article, is certainly correct. If they want to be a candidate for the Democratic nomination in 2016, they better get out right now in terms of agreement with the 2012 Democratic platform that calls for the legalization of same-sex marriage. Once again, we just have to wonder how much credibility these people should have. They're condemning the position they once held and holding the position they once condemned. And in this case, it's the timing of the issue that makes the political angle exceedingly clear. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. For more information, go to my website at albertmohler.com. You can follow me on Twitter by going to twitter.com/Albert Mohler. For information on the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, just go to sbts.edu. For information on Boyce College, just go to boycecollege.com. I'll meet you again tomorrow for The Briefing.